I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Today, Commission on Pensions and Retirement, July 8, 2004. We have a couple items on our agenda, but I think in fairness to the members, we're going to move to item 3, and that will be review and approval of actuarial consulting firm selection and actuarial services contract recommended by the Joint Retirement System Administrators. And I'd ask Mr. Martin to walk us through his memorandum, and then we'll go to the table.
Yes, members, the primary reason for this meeting is a mandate in some 2004 legislation, specifically Chapter 223, which changed the manner in which the consulting actuary who performs the actuarial valuations for the 14 statewide and major local pension plans is selected. Since 1984, the Pension Commission had been responsible for selecting the consulting actuary. For a number of reasons, that was deemed ought to be appropriately shifted to the seven pension fund administrators rather than to the Pension Commission. And the first selection of a consulting actuary occurred in the month of June. A requirement of Chapter 223 is that the Pension Commission ratify the contract with the consulting actuary, and that's the function that the Commission is undertaking today. Previously, we have sent you a memorandum trying to lay out the process that was anticipated by Laws 2004, Chapter 223, and what the seven pension fund administrators did in response. The actuary is obligated to perform the actuarial valuations for as of July 1, 2004, and that's the urgency to have the selection ratified as early in July as possible. That's what we're that's why a July meeting was requested of the Pension Commission. Basically, the seven pension fund administrators were obligated to meet, put out RFPs, interviews potential consulting actuaries, select a consulting actuary who would perform the official actuarial evaluations for the plans, and to negotiate a contract. That process has been performed. One of the pension fund administrators was designated as the lead individual in doing the various administrative and ministerial functions under the process, and the Public Employees Retirement Association, Mary Vanek, the executive director of PERA, performs that function. She has provided you in the packets a copy of the contract. It's the letter size document that has various colors, red and blue, as well as black items. I think maybe at this time it would be appropriate to have PERA present the contract and indicate the selection of the consulting actuary, if we could.
Ms. Vanek.
Members, while they're coming down, I should note we're using a different recording system now. The House has done away with a tape recording, our recording system, and it's gone digital. So we're using a digital recording mechanism. One of the aspects of that is that the recording of this meeting will be on the Internet after the meeting. So if you want to record your thoughts for posterity, you now have a chance.
I don't know how to prepare to speak.
Or delete.
Hmm?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Mary Vanek. I'm the Executive Director of PERA, and with me is Dave DeYoung, the Assistant Director of PERA, and it is actually Mr. DeYoung who is going to be responsible for managing the contract on my behalf, making sure bills get paid and that we're adhering to the provisions of the contract. So I've invited him to be at the table with me today. It took us a little longer to sort through the specific language of the contract, only because as a state agency and through the statute, we were required to use state procedures for bidding and entering into this contract. The typical language of a state contract refers to the state. But parties to this contract are not state agencies, the First Class City Teacher Funds and MRF. So we had to work with the Department of Administration's contract manager, Mr. Jerry Joyce, to make sure that he was comfortable that we removed reference to the state as party to the contract and instead referred to collectively the funds. So a lot of the red line outs you will see throughout the contract language are specifically related to replacing state with the funds, because we are, in fact, the parties to the contract. The blue language changes that you find specifically on page 3 were items that slightly changed typical state contract language to adhere to concerns that the Siegel Company had about the state, the actual words that were used. In consulting with our attorney, he advised that in most cases it did not significantly change the meaning and the intent of the state contract, and therefore he was comfortable with us proceeding with the changes. Specifically under liability, there's reference to resulting from negligent or wrongful acts in performance of service. Under the contract, it's just a different way of stating performance of this contract by the contractor or contractor's agency or agents or employees. It's really language changes that are of no significant consequence. Just people wanted it stated differently. On page 4, under termination, we were specifically referring under item 15 that we had the right to cancel this contract with 30 days' notice if we so chose. And the contractor asked that they be considered or be given the same right to notify, give us 30 days' notice if they wanted to cancel the contract. And it is clarified to note that whether we cancel or the contractor cancels, the net result is we pay for services rendered up until that date and nothing more. So they're really insignificant changes overall. The scope of the contract is really the last two pages, and this was taken specifically out of the RFP, the provisions of services that the firms bid on, and that is the annual experience studies, the quadrennial experience studies, the annual valuation reports, the report to this body, the results of those valuations, and special estimates of proposed changes in the plan structure or benefits. And we just attached that so that you could see that that was what was expected to be included under the law. That's what has been included. With respect to the process, I'd just like to go quickly through how we carried this out. We met as a group on May 3rd because although we had met with commission staff and the subcommittee in late February, early March, the actual bill wasn't enacted, and we were hoping it would be fast-tracked. When it wasn't enacted as quickly as we had hoped for, we decided we had to meet anyway. We at least had to try to get a process in place, expecting it would be enacted and we'd proceed. Usually when we do an RFP, we start in February for a June effective date or end of June effective date. So here we're starting early May. We put together a agreement on how we would vote, how we would make decisions, a timeline, and we did, in fact, although Mr. Martin makes reference that he wasn't informed, we did email to him on May 7th an outline of our process, our timelines, and a copy of the draft RFP, and I apologize if he didn't doesn't have a record of that, but if you want it, I've got copies of it. In that fast track proposal, we asked specifically about this meeting because in our schedule, we knew we couldn't get a finalized contract to you for approval any time before this. There's just no feasible way to do it. So our number one question was, if we have to have this approval, can the commission meet this week? So we really appreciate you being here. It's going to help us get this thing done. One of the major concerns we noted in the memo was that we didn't publish notice of the meetings that we had about the contract in the way that was intended. And although it isn't clear to us what was really intended, we do agree. I will admit that the meeting on June 10th, I failed to publish notice of that in our building. So when the subcommittee got together, and that was the three statewide funds and one representative from the First Class City Teacher Funds, I did bring to their attention at that point, we can't make any decisions, we can't have any discussion at this meeting because I failed to publish notice of this meeting. So at that point in time, we handed out the evaluation forms, we set another date for a meeting, I notified staff immediately that it was going to be a week later, and we decided how we were going to proceed. And because everybody's time frames were tight, we asked Mr. DeYoung to fill out the evaluation forms, copies of which you have in your packet, and to route those to everybody to see whether or not we were in agreement with how he rated the proposals we received. We got comments back on the 17th from the subcommittee members on the scoring of the proposals, and the meeting was very brief. Mr. Beerick did show up. We were in our boardroom, although there were just five of us there, so we were at one end of the boardroom, and I believe he didn't see us, and he came up to our floor looking for us, and by the time he found out where we were done. It was a 15-minute meeting. It was very clear on its face that based upon this chart that you have in your packet, that two of the firms, EFI and Mellon, were almost twice the cost proposed by the two lower firms, the Siegel Company and Milliman. And we didn't feel that there was really any need to interview two firms that came in at that substantially higher cost because none of us felt we could negotiate down to a level where we had budgeted, and we had budgeted similar to costs proposed by Milliman and the Siegel Company. So the decision was made we would interview those two firms. They already knew the interview date through the RFP process. They had already acknowledged that they would be available on June 22nd for the interviews. And so we just proceeded to set up those appointments and to have those interviews take place on the 22nd. We posted that in our building. And in retrospect, if I would have been thinking, I guess, I would have asked commission to staff to post it on your website. And if we have to go through this again, definitely will. We don't post these kind of meetings on our website. We don't have that kind of a page in our website that anyone would go to. But we would, and certainly if we are successful, if we're all comfortable with this process in the future, we will definitely allow more time and get it in the state register. We weren't able to get it in the state register with this short time frame. There's a lead time you need for that, and therefore couldn't get there. That being said, we feel very comfortable that it was a fair process. It was a governmental process. We were guided through the entire step through by the Department of Administration. We followed their rules. The interview was available. Both of your commission staff members were at the interviews. They were asked to participate, ask questions if they had any. They were there during our discussion of the results of the interviews. We asked them if they had any comments on our final selection when we decided on Siegel. They offered some comments and just advised that we would have this meeting today. So with that, I will. I ask that you approve the Siegel contract. It came in at the lowest bid. We did ask them, do you really understand the magnitude of this? Personally, collectively, the fund directors think that the bid is a bit low, but they know the work that needs to be done. They have to carry out the work, and therefore, we're going to proceed with them. They have a good reputation. We did reference checks. We know other funds that have used them in the past. We know that they've bid on all of our contracts in the past, so we've had other conversations with them, and we feel comfortable that they will provide a good service to this commission and to the funds collectively for this process.
Any questions from any of the commissioners? Senator Betzold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a question. First, on the proposed contract, Ms. Vanek, you indicated that the liability section was just a word change. I think it's a little bit narrower, the language. As I read it, it's that the contractor must indemnify the funds and hold harmless, including attorney's fees, resulting the past language it says performance of this contract, and the new language has negligent or wrongful acts in the performance. That does seem to me a bit narrower grounds for the indemnification. It may be appropriate, but it just seems to me that it may have fewer things that the funds can seek indemnity for. So I'm not sure it's just a change of words. I mean, if it was just a change of words, why do it? So I think there's a purpose there. The second item I would note on the termination is that normally the government has the right to terminate a contract for the convenience of the government, because things change in government, and the government cannot always be bound. They can't obviously get a windfall, and they cannot take advantage of a situation, but if the circumstances change because of budget shortfalls or whatever, that usually is allowed. I can understand why why Siegel would want the same opportunity to cancel on 30 days' notice. Where would that leave us if they were to cancel on 30 days' notice? So those are just two issues that I come.
Ms. Vanek, on those two questions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, I am not an attorney, so I apologize if I misrepresented the liability language. All I know is that our attorney felt like it was appropriate change, and he didn't feel that we should be concerned, overly concerned about it, and that he felt comfortable with us accepting it. With respect to the cancellation, when I talked to Mr. Joyce about why do we typically not allow the contractor to have that option, he said that primarily it is so that if a firm all of a sudden gets a better contract than the one entered into with the state, they can't turn around and just cancel on us. We don't have that specific concern with the Siegel Company because we know that they've been anxious to get exposure in the state of Minnesota and work with the funds and the legislature on this for quite some time. The other issue that we have is when I polled the fund directors about that request by the contractor, all but one of us have our own consulting actuary for our boards. And everybody agreed that we at least would have our own consulting actuary to prepare work for us while we went through the process to rebid if the Siegel Company were to terminate this contract. So everybody felt comfortable accepting the language. And Mr. Joyce indicated that he didn't think that there was any reason why we couldn't be comfortable accepting this.
But Mr. Chair,
Betzold.
Ms. Vanek, If Siegel were to cancel on 30 days' notice, maybe because they bid low and then realize this is far more work and far more expensive than they intended to get into when they pull out, do you have any idea how long it would take to go through this process again and find some replacement? And where would that leave us during the interim?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Senator Betzold, well, I think we got it done in about 6 weeks this time. I think we could do it again if we had to. But again, in the meantime, what it would mean is that we would have to rely on our own consulting actuaries to the boards to provide information that would have to be verified later by a joint consultant once one was in place.
Senator
Mr. Chair, just on a different issue, on the review of the firms that applied, you have your scoring sheets. EFI comes in at 77, Mellon at 81, Milliman at 93, and Siegel scored 94, all out of 100. I think you indicated that the deciding cost in Milliman was that you felt that they were far too expensive. I do note, though, that apparently since Milliman and Siegel scored almost the same, and they were the two higher ones, the difference came in Milliman getting assigned qualifications at a score of 27 out of 30, whereas Siegel got 28 out of 30. It just seems a little odd. How could you describe how the qualifications were decided here, since we had two firms that all but seemed alike, but one that had been doing the work here scored 1 point lower than the other? It seems a little strange.
Mr. Chair and Senator Batzold, our concern primarily with Milliman is the fact that Mr. Custis indicated that if Milliman was awarded the contract, he would likely stay with the firm for the duration of the contract, but that is not assured. We, as fund directors, have been very comfortable working with Mr. Custis and Milliman over the 13 years that the LCPR has been contracted with them. But that being said, he is a key piece of that relationship because of his knowledge of our systems and his ability to communicate. Mr. Hogan is being groomed to take his place. We are not as comfortable with Mr. Hogan's ability to communicate the issues, and that is key for your understanding, that they have a spokesperson who can really get to the core of the issues we have facing us. The plus side for Siegel was that they have good communicators. Your staff, or I think Larry at least, is familiar with Kathy Eidelberg, who works with the Siegel Company, is well-regarded as having great communication skills in dealing with pension fund issues. And they bring a fresh approach to the funds and to you as legislators as we face some very, very difficult decisions going forward with our funds.
Just, Mr. Chair, just as a comment, when we had a subcommittee of this commission that did look at the contract last, 2 years ago, I think it was, and it was between basically EFI and Milliman, and at that time, Mr. Custis did make it clear that, you know, he, although he wanted to stay around, he indicated that he was starting to phase out and they would be passing off their responsibilities to Mr. Hogan, and that was a concern that we had raised at that time, too. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Smith. My questions were about the same as Senator Betzold's. With one addition, Ms. Vanek, did you say the Department of Administration also did review the contract, specifically the changes in liability?
Ms. Vanek.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, they did. We discussed this with them.
And Mr. Chair and Ms. Vanek, they found no problems with the concern that Senator Betzold raised, which would be mine, that the use of negligent or wrongful acts would be comprehensive enough to cover any kind of performance that we might question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erickson, they relied on our attorney's advice in reviewing, and he reviews all our state contracts. And they indicated that they would support the position of our attorney.
Thanks. Other questions? Ms. Vanek, tell us again the number of other states that the proposed actuarial firm represents or has done work for.
Mr. Chair, I know North Dakota. Nevada's been a long-time client of theirs. They're doing some special work with Iowa. I don't remember off the top of my head.
Mr. DeYoung? And maybe if you could, when you're reading those states, tell me also the length of time that they've been representing those states, when they've been hired, how long they've taken care of those states, and then I'd like to go from there.
Mr. Chair, they have listed in their proposal Iowa, 2 years retained, Michigan, 10 years, Nevada, 29 years, New Mexico, 2 years, North Dakota, 27 years, Ohio, 3 years, Pennsylvania, 21 years, Texas, 11 years, and the Virgin Islands, 31 years.
Now, Mr. DeYoung, in those numbers of years in those different states, have they taken care of all of the pension work, or is this...
Mr. Chair, no. Some of these, they do auditing work. Some of these, they do special projects. Some of these, they do all of the actuarial work.
Which ones of the list you just read, are they the consulting actuary for everything that state or entity needs?
My understanding is North Dakota, Nevada, and Michigan. And I'm not really sure on the others. In Iowa, they do just a strategic planning.
Are there any states that have hired this firm or public entities where they have been terminated or had a bad experience that you're aware of?
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of.
The principal actuary proposed from Siegel would be Ms. Leslie L. Thompson. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Of the states you've listed where either their entire work was done by the Siegel Company or in part, was she the primary principal actuary on any of those?
Mr. Chair, she was. She's worked in Iowa, Nevada, New Mexico, North Dakota, those states.
Were there any negative experiences between her as principal actuary in any of those states?
Mr. Chair, not that we discovered, no.
Were you present at all of the public notices or any of the meetings?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, you were present at all of them?
Yes.
Was the question I just asked ever asked of
yes.
Siegel? And what was their response?
Their response, they've never had problems.
Tell me, what do you think of the two entities being interviewed and the other proposal submitted, if you will? What were the qualifications of the Siegel Company that you thought were most compelling over the other applicants, if you will?
Mr. Chair, there were several things. Siegel is known across the country as one of the top actuarial firms. And they have submitted proposals to PARA every time we've sent out an RFP. And they've always come in as the bridesmaid, so to speak. They've come in second each time for various reasons. But Leslie Thompson has an excellent reputation. Kathy Eidelberg is known across the country. So they bring in super folks, and that's what we really like about Siegel.
Mr. DeYoung or Ms. Vanek, when the state of Minnesota or this commission was needing to review its contract a couple of years ago and we were advertising for a new actuary, the Siegel Company did not come to us and offer their services. What was that reason? What was the reason for that?
Mr. Chair, I called Kathy Eidelberg to ask her because we were surprised. I know that they had bid in the past. Her response to me was that they had a sense in talking to people in the industry that the commission was comfortable with Milliman and that the odds were that Milliman would probably get the contract again. And at the point in time that the bids went out, they were fairly busy. They were just entering into a contract for strategic planning with Iowa, and they felt that they'd have another opportunity in the future to attempt to a bid on working with the Minnesota funds, and so they chose to decline at that time.
I think I have one more question here, and that is the states that you've listed, and not to slight the Virgin Islands, them as well, comprise states or public sector, if you will. That is not the entire makeup of the work of the Siegel Company. In fact, it's most of their work is not for states. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. About 20% of their work is related to the public pension industry. The other 80% is primarily Taft-Hartley plans, which not directly public, but not private, so to speak, either. That enables them to bring to us a pretty good diversity in understanding how different funds are operated in different levels of government, quasi-government areas.
If for some reason you have to go through the bid process again, are you going to clean up your act a little bit on the notice that
Mr. Chair, we
on the notice issue where there wasn't publication or whatever?
We will make sure we have enough lead time that we can publish in the State Register. I'm trusting that I'm public record today to ask that the LCPR be able to post our notices for us, since most people wouldn't go to our websites for that kind of information. And primarily what drove this is, in state law, you're required to get a valuation from us by December 1st. This is a tight time frame, and the state of Minnesota Department of Finance wants our information to them before Thanksgiving. It's going to be very difficult to meet all those deadlines starting at the point we're starting right now. So we do apologize. I will take full responsibility for not thinking to contact LCPR staff to post it on your website. I don't know. We were doing a lot, and I failed to think of avenues we had to post other than our building. It won't happen again. We'll make sure we get it posted so that people are aware.
Any other questions?
Sure.
Senator Pogamiller.
The interviewing committee was a 6-1 vote. Is the one comfortable with the selection?
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogamiller, Bill.
Ms. Vanek?
I believe, if I could speak for Mr. Kapler, he was comfortable with our decision.
So you want to say it?
Is he the one?
Well, because they'll be doing work for all these funds, so you'd want to make sure that.
Yeah. How strong of a dissent?
Mr. Chairman, members, Phil Kapler, St. Paul Teachers Retirement Fund. I was the lone dissenting vote, I guess, when we took the final tally to decide which of the two finalist firms to go with. And that really wasn't a statement or an indication of my perception of the competencies of Siegel. It was really more a matter of thinking of workload going into the fall August, September, October, despite the fact that Siegel is, I think, a really good organization and a deep organization. They have a lot to learn about particulars of our plans as they move forward to do these valuations. So there was the long-term issue and the short-term issue, and I think we've been satisfied with the relationship that we've had with Milliman up to this point, and thought they would continue to do a fine job, but it was, in my mind, there wasn't any sort of large gap between the two in terms of their competencies or ability. I think they were pretty much, it was a dead heat at that point.
So, Mr. Chairman, so are you comfortable?
Senator Pogamiller.
We are very comfortable with them.
He over-explained.
Yeah. Thank you. Other questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wants to be heard, who wants to provide any other perspective than those who have already offered their comments? Now's your opportunity.
Is Thompson here? Is the company?
For the record, I'll just ask this question. Is either Ms. Thompson or anyone from Siegel Company here? Please come forward. And Ms. Vanek, would you answer my question?
Mr. Chair, we didn't think to invite them. I know that Ms. Thompson is unavailable this week, and we asked commission staff if they had any questions of her when they were at the interview. And again, it's just an oversight on my part. Lisa did mention it to me when I talked to her about 2 o'clock last Friday afternoon, but at that time, I just decided not to invite them. And I apologize. That's an oversight on my part.
Very good. Any other questions from the commission or discussion? If not, the motion would be in order. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chair, I'll move that the professional and technical services contract proposed to us be approved.
Required a simple. Senator Larson.
I'll second.
Very good. Motion is before us. Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. That prevails. Very good. Let's move on to then the next item on the agenda. In fact, let's go to consideration of the approval of, and approval of the prior commission meeting minutes, which are in your packets. They're from the dates of February 10, February 17, February 23, March 3, and minutes from the executive committee dated February 23. They are there. Is there a motion for approval?
Mr. Chair, also moved.
Senator Betzold moves approval. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Those and those opposed, no. Motion prevails. Those minutes are adopted. Mr. Martin, let's go on to a discussion of a summary of our pension legislation enacted by the 2004 legislature.
Yes, members. Mr. Burek has prepared a summary of the 2004 session, and he'll now go through it briefly.
Members, the other memo in your packet is the summary of the 2004 session. The first plan that we cover there is MSRS General, and item number one is a provision to pass for MSRS General, and it was also enacted for several other plans, PERA, TRA, and the First Class City Teacher plans come to mind. That first provision is that salary for pension purposes can exclude grievance awards and legal settlements. Basically, language was added to the plans that would permit the executive directors to review those settlements, and they could be included in salary for pension purposes, most typically in the high five is when this issue becomes important, only if the executive director concludes that the arrangement is fully consistent with the plan's definition of salary. So this was a provision sought by the executive directors of some of these plans to avoid some abuses that they felt were occurring. Item number two, military leave provision is revised to conform to USERRA, the Uniformed Services Employment and Reemployment Rights Act. These changes were made for MSRS, applies to MSRS General, several other MSRS plans. Comparable changes were made in PERA, TRA, First Class City Teachers as well. What occurred here for MSRS General is that their military leave and service provision, which allows individuals to receive service credit in the plan for military service, was revised to be consistent with USERRA. Some of the revisions are changes in the salary base upon which the service credit contributions are to be computed. Basically, the salary during the leave would be used, and if that's not known, then it would be the salary immediately before the leave that would be used for purposes of computing the contributions. The maximum service that can be purchased is 5 years unless otherwise indicated in United States Code. The individual has an opportunity to purchase this service credit upon returning to covered employment, and the length of the period during which the individual can purchase that service is three times the length of the uniform service period, but that can't be less than 1 year nor more than 5 years. An important change here was that the interest on the contributions are shifted to the employer for both the employer contribution and the employee contribution. This was an effort to try to keep the plan whole while still being consistent with the USERRA requirements. Item number three there is a temporary reemployment benefit waiver reduction waiver. under a provision that was enacted for MSRS, individuals who are disabled and return to work can continue to receive the disability payments for the first during the first 6 months of employment. The change is temporary, which would allow the commission to review that if it so desired, to decide whether it should be permanent or not. So this change is effective until July 1, 2006. I can mention here that a comparable provision was enacted for para, although the para provision went a little bit further and tightened up a few issues that were just left unstated in the MSRS provision. With the para provision, a comparable change was made, but they also included language indicating that while the individual is in this six-month period, the individual cannot make contributions to the plan to receive additional service credit unless the individual decides to waive this continuation of the disability benefits. Moving on, there were several changes in MSRS General, all dealing with refunds. And the core one here is really number 6 on page 2, which is the a revision to the MSRS refund provision. The provision was amended to allow the refund to be included with 6% interest compounded daily rather than 6% interest based on monthly or fiscal year balances. And several other provisions in MSRS General dealing with refunds were revised essentially by cross-referencing that particular change. And as a result, comparable changes were made in various death refund provisions within MSRS. One other change we can mention here is item number 8. This was is a special law provision for a survivor. This was a provision that passed for an individual who was employed by the House of Representatives, somewhat later was employed by the Senate, and died shortly after starting that Senate employment. The special law allows the individual to transfer some contributions that had been transferred to MSRS General. Those would be transferred back to the MSRS Unclassified Plan, where that individual used to have coverage. For purposes of creating a death benefit for the survivors. Item number 9, the MSRS Full Actuarial Value Military Service Credit provision is revised and extended. This provision was going to be repealed effective May 16, 2004. It was extended to 2006, and language in the provision which had prohibited a purchase if the individual was entitled to a current or deferred military pension is removed from the language. There was also a change in the MSRS Department of Transportation pilot's early retirement reduction provision. That provision had waived early retirement reductions if the individual had retired at age 62 because of a Department of Transportation policy document which required individuals to retire at 62, which is less than the normal retirement age for that plan. The policy document was revised, allowing individuals to continue to age 65, which for the individuals involved is a normal retirement age. But language was revised to allow a continued waiver of the of any early retirement reduction. For the legislator's plan, there was a comparable change in refund language comparable to the MSRS general change, which I mentioned above, basically allowing daily compounding of interest on a refund rather than annual. For the MSRS correctional plan, the legislature added a few positions to that plan. Those positions are in the Rush City facility. And the positions are the corrections discipline unit supervisor, the dental hygienist, and psychologist two. The changes The military service credit purchase provision for consistency with USERRA that I mentioned earlier also apply to this plan. And finally, there was some clarification of duty-related and non-duty-related disability eligibility to indicate that individuals can be eligible for disability, provided the individual is expected to be disabled for at least 1 year. That language is commonly found in nearly all our plans. Moving to MSRS Unclassified, first provision there is a repeal of a provision that has now become obsolete as the TRA basic members leave TRA. At this point, I believe there are no basic members left in that plan, and as a result, there was no need for that particular provision in MSRS Unclassified. Next, the disability benefit provisions payable by MSRS Unclassified and the surviving spouse benefits were made more flexible. Under prior law, individuals could elect a withdrawal of the entire value of the account in a lump sum or half the account in a lump sum. Both the disability benefit and surviving spouse benefit provisions were made more flexible by allowing any combination to be used. Individuals can withdraw any portion of the account that they so choose. The item number five I mentioned already, that's the deceased House Senate employee provision, allowing that transfer back to MSRS General. Moving to the State Patrol, the first provision there defines salary for pension purposes. The State Patrol plan is an MSRS-administered plan, and one of the changes there was that salary for the State Patrol plan would be identical to salary as defined in MSRS General. A military leave break in service provision was added to the plan. The provision added to the plan is consistent with USERRA. Item number five on page four, there was a clarification in the State Patrol plan disability provisions indicating to more clearly indicate when the transfer from disability status to retirement status will occur. And the language that was added is language comparable to that that's been used in many other plans in the last several years. Basically, that transfer will occur at age 65 or the five-year anniversary of the effective date of the disability benefit, whichever is later. Item number seven is a clarification of surviving spouse benefits. Members may recall that we pointed out when we were dealing with the administrative legislation that the language that had been in law was not comprehensible. So we sat down with MSRS staff, asked them what specific benefits they had been providing to these various groups, and we tried to state that more clearly in law. There are several different groups here. For active members, there are active members who might die before they become vested. In other words, before they have 3 years of service, or active members might die in service after becoming vested, but before the normal retirement age, which for this plan is age 55, or they could die while active after the normal retirement age. There are also a group of surviving spouses of disabilities to be dealt with here. So there are several categories. We tried to correctly capture the benefits that the plan had been providing all along and state that in law. There is language indicating that if the executive director determines that any of these changes did in any way revise the benefits compared to what they had been providing, that the executive director is supposed to recommend some corrective language to the LCPR. Number eight, the State Patrol plan full actuarial value military service credit provision was revised. This change is consistent with that that was made in MSRS General and also similar changes in para TRA, first class city teacher plans. Basically, the provision is extended 2 years and the prohibition against a service credit purchase if the individual is entitled to a current or deferred military pension was removed. Moving to the judge's plan, a provision was added to that plan for military leaves, breaks in service to be consistent with USERRA. That's item number one there. Again, comparable to the language that's been added elsewhere for other plans. Item number three under the judge's plan is a change in the treatment of refunds. Like the various other MSRS plans, this provision is changed to allow daily interest to be paid on a refund rather than annual or something based on fiscal year balances. And in addition, the refund provision in the judge's plan was revised to allow payment of 6% interest on a refund rather than 5%. The various other MSRS plans and most of the other plans, certainly the statewide plans, para TRA, and the MSRS plans are all at 6% interest at the current time. The MSRS privatized employee chapter, there was a revision there to clarify surviving spouse and dependent child benefits. That change simply is a clarification to indicate that if a covered member dies, the surviving spouse and dependent children will be eligible for surviving spouse and dependent child benefits as specified in MSRS general law that was in effect at the time of the privatization. There was a similar change made in the para privatization chapter as well. To the bottom of page 5, starting with the MSRS general, first item we can mention is item number 3 there. That's the salary for pension purposes can exclude grievance award and legal settlements. I mentioned that comparable changes were made in similar changes were made in MSRS general law. And that is being made in para law here as well. Number 4, the para general military leave break and service provision is revised to be consistent with USERRA. Number 5, clarification of reemployed annuity reallocations. Given some changes in Social Security law, some of the language in para-general law dealing with reemployed annuitants had become obsolete. So basically that provision was changed to eliminate law language that no longer had any effect given the changes in Social Security law. As Social Security law has been revised and as para law has now been revised, there's no withholding or reduction of a benefit to a reemployed annuitant after the individual reaches a normal retirement age under Social Security, which would be between age 65 and 67, depending upon the individual's date of birth. Number 7 we mentioned earlier with the under MSRS General. This is the disability benefit continuation for 6 months when the individual returns to employment. Two clarifications or additions that are included here that weren't included in the similar MSRS provision is that the contributions made to the plan are not allowed if the individual continues to receive the disability benefit. The individual can make contributions, receive service credit, only if the individual waives the continuation of those disability benefits. And there is language indicating that the individual could use this provision only once. This is probably in response to concerns that LCPR staff raised when we were discussing this issue. We indicated some concern that individuals might seek employment receive the salary from that employment as well as continuation of the disability benefit. And then after a brief period of time, the individual could perhaps go back on disability and then go back into this program again to receive this kind of double coverage. So Para suggested adding language that if the individual uses this once, that's it. It cannot be used again. Number nine, Lake Joanna Volunteer Fire Department was added to Para's governmental subdivision provision. Essentially, that means that that fire department is considered to be a public employer for Para purposes, and thus its employees, if they're otherwise eligible for a Para plan, can make contributions to the plan and be members. Item number 11 on page 7 is the provision for the Goodhue County Commissioner who had Para PNF and Para General Coverage. This was an individual who was covered by Para Police and Fire, was elected to the Goodhue County Board, and for that elected employment decided to have Para General Coverage rather than either no coverage or coverage by the Para Defined Contribution Plan. We have had some troubles in recent years because individuals had this double coverage either due to two types of employment, one non-elected, the other elected in Para General, or in this case elected service in Para General and other service in Para Police and Fire. In these situations, we've had individuals who seek to start drawing the annuity from the non-elected service, but under Para law, if an individual is covered by a Para plan, unless it is the Para defined contribution plan, for any employment, the individual cannot begin to draw an annuity from the Para plan or plans. So language was enacted similar to that used a few times in the last few years, which essentially undoes the election and treats the individual as though the individual had not elected the Para General Coverage. So the individual can begin, in this case, drawing the Para Police and Fire annuity, and then some actions are to be undertaken to decide what to do with that Para General coverage and contributions that were made for the elected service. The individual is allowed to either request a refund of that, or the amounts can be rolled into the Para defined contribution plan, and the individual can have continued coverage there. Number 12, Para full actuarial value military service credit provision revised and extended. This is comparable to the changes that I've mentioned elsewhere. This is extended from May 2004 to May 2006, and the prohibition against this service credit purchase if the individual is entitled to a current or deferred military pension is removed from law. Moving on to the Para privatization chapter, Chapter 353F, there was a clarification in law to indicate that a surviving spouse or dependent child can receive benefits as stated in Para law at the time of the privatization. Numbers 2 and 3 are two different different ways that the Commission and Legislature handled privatizations during this last session. Under item number 2, Fair Oaks Lodge, Wadena, and Kennebec Hospital, Red Villa Nursing Home, and St. Peter Community Health Care Center were added to the Para privatization chapter. So given that treatment, they will be treated as privatized employees and have certain continuing rights for purposes of computing Rule of 90 benefits and also enhanced augmentation. Some other groups have requested that they be allowed to remain in Para General, and the Commission and Legislature did decide to allow those individuals to remain in Para General. Those are covered in item number 3. And those individuals who will continue in Para General are the Government Training Center employees and the Achieve Program employees at Anoka County. Moving on to para, police, and fire. Two issues there we could mention. Item number two is the temporary waiver of the reemployment reallocations. Reallocation of the para, police, and fire benefit due to reemployment of an annuitant will not occur. It will be waived until June 30th, 2007. And item number three is the revised para, police, and fire disability benefit application review procedures. Basically, what's stated there is the application must be in writing on forms provided by the executive director. There has to be adequate proof of disability. There's a requirement there for medical examinations and continuing medical examinations if an individual is declared to be disabled. The individual must release all medical records to PARA to allow them to make these determinations. And the application, if it's filed within 2 years of the date of injury, the termination will be based on the individual's ability to perform the services provided when the injury or illness occurred. If the application is more than 2 years later, then it's the most recent duties to which the individual is assigned that will be the determination factor. Moving on to TRA, number two is that language we've discussed a few times now, dealing with grievance awards and legal settlements, allowing the executive director to exclude that from the high five if the director determines that that settlement is really not in the nature of salary for pension purposes. Item number three is the revision in TRA's military leave provision for consistency with USERRA. We've covered that before. There's a few provisions relating to MIDSCU. Item number four is has clarification of just how full-time and part-time salary credit will be determined for MIDSCU employees. It will be based on the full-time employment as defined and contained in the collective bargaining agreements. Item number seven is a revision in TRA law that TRA had requested. TRA indicated it felt that this change was necessary for consistency with federal code requirements and to allow TRA to remain as a qualified plan. What changes is indicated here is a statement of how the situation is to be handled if it is decided sometime after the occurrence, sometime after the initial occurrence, what to do with contributions that were made in error to the plan. There's some federal code language that specifies that once money has been in a pension plan for a certain period of time, and there's some confusion on this as to whether that is 6 months or 1 year, the money must be considered assets of the plan, even if it's later determined that those contributions or transfers were made in error. So if TRA is in that situation and it finds that an error was made but it can't refund or return the contributions without running into plan qualification problems, an arrangement has been worked out which hopefully keeps everyone whole and keeps TRA consistent with the federal code. Basically, the employer would make any necessary transfers to the proper plan, ensure that the proper plan gets the coverage, and TRA would allow credits to that particular employer to in turn keep that employer whole. Item number eight is some language added to deal with MIDSCU employees who were initially excluded from TRA because the initial employment in MIDSCU was less than 25% employment. and who later decide, who later continue on with MinSKU and decide that they want TRA coverage. The provision allows MinSKU to make contributions for that employee to TRA, covering the employer and employee contributions plus interest for that initial period. And then MinSKU would then recapture the employee contribution amount and interest on the employee contribution amount from the employee through salary withholding. This will be allowed to occur only if the initial employment was within the last 36 months. And this was to avoid concerns where people might decide to delay that purchase of service credit until very late in their career and have that service worth far, far more than the contributions that TRA would receive. So that was the justification for using this 36-month or three-year cutoff. Moving on to page 10, number 13, some language was enacted which requires TRA to audit the salary as contained in TRA's records for individuals who have salary in excess of 95% of the governor's salary. Basically, TRA is required to audit those amounts, ensure that all those amounts are consistent with TRA's definition of salary prior to paying an annuity based on the high five as indicated in TRA's records. Now, we note that there is an inconsistency in the law that was enacted. One of the provisions requires TRA to audit these amounts, and those audits are to occur when individuals have salary in excess of 95% of the governor's salary. But the reporting language did pick up the revision. This provision, as it was going through, there were a few different versions that appeared from time to time. And the report language continues to require TRA to report on the number of superintendents, assistant superintendents, and principals who retired during the year. At one time, the audit was to be done for that group, but as the language passed, the language stated that it was to be done in any case where the salary was in excess of 95% of the governor's salary. So there's some inconsistency there that at some point could use some cleaning up. Item number 17 is a revision in TRA law for computing surviving spouse benefits. In cases where an individual has died prior to receiving any annuity. As the provision is revised, the individual, the spouse's annuity will be based on the member at death and the age of the surviving spouse when the surviving spouse decides to draw that annuity. That should result in a slightly higher benefit to the surviving spouse in any case where the surviving spouse does not immediately begin to receive that annuity. Item 18, non-married members may designate a beneficiary to receive a surviving spouse benefit or a surviving spouse-like benefit. This change allows an individual who is not married to designate in writing a beneficiary to receive a surviving spouse benefit, but other TRA law indicates that that beneficiary must be either a former spouse or a biological or adopted child. Number 21 on page 11 is TRA's change in its full actuarial value military service credit provision. Again, that is extended to 2006 with revisions comparable to that which we've already mentioned a few times previously. Moving on to first-class city teachers, number one is changes in first-class city teacher law dealing with the grievance award legal settlements. Again, that allows the executive director to exclude any amounts that aren't consistent with or comparable to salary under that plan. Number two is the change in the military leave break and service credit provision in the first class city teacher plans for consistency with USERRA. Number three extends some filing deadlines for teachers who are legislators and who are part of the qualified part-time teacher program. Basically, rather than having to have the agreements signed and the copies of the contracts sent to TRA by October 1st, individuals would have until March 1st, so which gives them a few more months to sign those forms and to have them sent to the First Class City Teacher Fund, whichever one is applicable. I should also mention that comparable changes were made in TRA law, paralleling this change here. Item number four is a repeal of a provision allowing certain pension plans to use as funding sources for repayments of refunds and purchases of service credit for leaves of absences. Language paralleling this was added in Chapter 356, which deals with retirement plans generally and covers the First Class City Teacher plans and many other plans. As a result, the language in the First Class City law became redundant and therefore was repealed. Number five is the extension for the First Class City teachers of the full actuarial value of military service credit provisions. We've mentioned that many times. For IRAP, IRAP eligibility was expanded to include unclassified managers and professionals in academic and academic support provisions employed by MNSCU. There is equality created in the employee contributions for all IRAP members. Previously, there were some IRAP members who had an option to be covered by MSRS unclassified, and if they had that option, the contribution to IRAP was only to be 4%, which is the same employee contribution as exists for the MSRS unclassified plan. That was eliminated, however, allowing individuals to make the same contribution to IRAP that all other members make, which is a 4.5% of pay contribution. Number four is a provision that allows certain IRAP members who had some prior time covered by TRA or First Class City Teacher Plan and who elected to have the employee contributions plus interest that they had made to that defined benefit plan transferred over to IRAP. There is a change in law that allows these individuals to access those amounts upon termination of service rather than upon retirement. And this ability to access IRAP amounts is consistent with the way the remainder of the IRAP account is covered. Individuals, when they terminate service, have access to their IRAP account. So this cleans up something that was an annoyance for some of these members. Moving on to Minneapolis Fire Relief Association, there was a further change in the executive secretary's salary provision. The change was that the maximum salary amount that was put in law 2 years ago, 50% of the maximum salary of first grade firefighter, was made to apply only if the executive secretary is an active member. If the executive secretary is not an active member, then the executive secretary would be limited to the maximum salary received by one of the statewide pension plans. Changes that were passed for Minneapolis Police and Fire, and there were several changes for this group that were passed. First change would extend the amortization period from 2010, as existed in current law, to 2020. The argument for that was to lessen the burden on the city to try to cover the unfunded liability as it currently exists for this plan by 2010. It stretches it out and therefore limits the burden on them in any particular year. Accompanying that change were various benefit-related changes for the plan members. One was in the 13th check. Rather than having to meet the rate of return trigger for a over a five-year period, that was shortened rather to 2 years. That will allow the individual the plan to make a 13th check payment sooner as they come out of the bad investment market period that we've recently gone through. There was an increase in the service credit by one unit, in fact, approximately $78 a month for service retirees who have more than 20 years of service. Comparable changes were made in survivor benefit provisions for the plan as well, and some language that suggested that the pension plan should reduce benefits when benefits fall below when the funding ratio rather falls below 90% was stricken from law. The Minneapolis police changes and the Minneapolis fire changes all required local approval. And it was our understanding that the city was considering approving the Minneapolis police, rather Minneapolis fire change a few days ago. But it's holding off on the Minneapolis consideration of the Minneapolis police change. Moving on to volunteer fire relief associations, there were some changes in the non-refundable portion of a service pension provision. This provision in volunteer fire law withholds a certain portion of the benefit that has otherwise accrued to an individual. It is a provision in law that attempts to get people to continue to provide service until they hit at least the 20-year point. The change that was enacted for defined contribution plans. And the change reduces that non-forfeitable percentage table so that the individual can receive a full benefit, the benefit earned to date, with as little as 10 years of service rather than 20 years of service. This was passed in two forms. One is a general law provision applying to all defined contribution volunteer fire plans, and another as a special law provision, identical in nature, however, for Marine on St. Croix. Item number two, there was another change or another option provided in the way interest can be paid on a deferred pension. The one enacted last year allows payment of 5% interest based on the actual rate of return, actual time-weighted rate of return of the association special fund, providing that the bylaws are amended to allow that treatment. The treatment is temporary, expires at the end of 2008. So if the commission legislature so desires, they can review that, decide whether to continue that treatment or not. Some language was passed for Bellingham Firefighter Relief Association ratifying some annuities that they had purchased, although annuities are not authorized investments for volunteer fire plans or for any other plans. There was a change in the Ambulance Service Personnel Longevity Award and Incentive Program. This is a program the Commission hasn't heard about in several years because there hasn't been any changes that had any pension-related impact. But there was a change this year revising the maximum salaries that various eligible individuals can receive and still be included in within that incentive award program. Moving on to general pension provisions, there is a provision of the law that caps or capped for many state employees anyway the maximum amount of their salary that can be used for pension purposes, and that cap was 95% of the governor's salary. This was revised to exclude from that cap all judges, virtually all state employees, including Minsky employees, executive branch, legislative branch, and judicial branch employees, Gillette Hospital employees who happen to have MSR's general coverage, and employees of the Minnesota Crop Improvement Council and the Minnesota Historical Society. The changes were retroactive to handle a situation where individuals have already started drawing annuities where the salary that was used in computing those pensions may well have exceeded 95% of the governor's salary. Item number four, LCPR, actuarial service billing to third parties, language passed to clarify the commission's ability to bill third parties for actuarial services where the service was performed for their benefit under the commission's contract, and any amounts that the commission received could be placed in the commission's budget. That was retroactive to July 1, 2003. Item number five, changes were made in the laws of many different plans, as noted there, allowing but not mandating the use of chiropractors and psychologists in disability benefit determinations. There's various changes that were made for Federal Internal Revenue compliance under item 8 there. Commission and subcommittee of the commission spent a considerable amount of time dealing with those issues. These are all changes that the pension plans concluded were necessary in their plans or in Chapter 356, dealing with pension plans in general, for Internal Revenue Code or other federal law compliance. Under miscellaneous provisions, the most notable item there is the shift in the actuarial service provider to the pension fund administrators. I've got a summary of that there. I won't cover it, though, since that was covered extensively already in the earlier item on your agenda. Moving to the last page, MSRS healthcare plan. That healthcare plan was revised to allow the plan to reimburse active employees for healthcare related costs. Previously, that had only been authorized for individuals who are already in retirement status. And finally, we note that the Legislative Coordinating Commission is required to study the existing salary cap for local government units. That cap is 95% of the governor's salary, and that group is supposed to report to various House and Senate committees on recommendations they may have for revising, removing that cap, whatever action they may recommend. Down the line, that might have some implications for the LCPR because of the salary cap for credit purposes provisions that are in law. With those comments, I turn it back to the chairman.
Very good. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Bethold.
It might be instructive if staff can remember. The one item I know that left the commission in our bill when it left here was the statewide firefighter study that was deleted on a House floor memo. Were there any other issues that we had proposed having in here that did not make it in the final bill that passed out of the Pension Commission? I mean, we had some floor amendments, we had other committee amendments along the way that were deleted, but I'm just trying to remember if there were any commission actions that didn't make it.
Mr. Chairman, members,
Mr. Berg,
that's the only one that
that's
we
the
are
only
aware
one.
Of.
Okay, thank you.
Anything else? Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogomiller.
I think you and Senator Bedsold ought to be congratulated. You got kind of the wheels back on the vehicle, and
Got quite a bit done last year. There were a couple displacements and things that didn't get done, but that that was not related to the commission as much as it was to the executive branch not wanting to tackle them last session. I thought you did a good job last year.
Senator Pogamiller, I appreciate that, and Senator Betzold was relatively easy to work with.
Well, Mr. Chair, we don't have these staggered terms, so I didn't have the pressure on me to.
And with that, are there any other issues before this body? Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair Smith. Staff, can you tell us whether or not you can verify what Representative Knobloch said on the House floor before we took the vote on the pension bill, and that was that the unfunded liability of all pensions in Minnesota is $6.4 billion.
And that question is directed to who?
To staff.
Members, the Knobloch number came from a publication, a state government's publication. I had the opportunity to appear before the Ways and Means Committee during the course of the session. I did try and replicate that number and could not replicate it exactly. Depending upon whether you include or don't include volunteer fire plans and which plans you're looking at, I can either produce a smaller number or a somewhat larger number, but I cannot produce the exact number. So I'm not sure how the magazine computed its number, so it's somewhat difficult. The unfunded accrued liability is complicated by the fact that we use the actuarial value of assets when we compute our official numbers, and if you use the market value of assets, what market value you're using does have implications for that number. We do have a somewhat sizable unfunded accrued liability. If the magazine computed all unfunded liabilities by all states, then the suggestion that our ranking makes sense, but I don't know what methodology they actually used. I did look at the magazine article, and they weren't clear as to their methodology, so... we do have a significant but not unmanageable unfunded accrued liability. That's about as far as I can ascertain the accuracy of the magazine article.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Mr. Chair, I also would like to know if it would be okay to request staff to spend the rest of the interim coming up with some suggestions for solving the Minneapolis Teacher Retirement Fund problem. I am a member of TRE, and in our last newsletter it was noted that, it's, and we already knew this, of course, really important that we solve this dilemma. And my organization, I think, is saying that, if there's a joining of TRA and Minneapolis Teacher Retirement Association, and St. Paul was not mentioned, but I suppose that's possible, too, that money has to accompany that, and I'm just curious as to whether staff can put together some ideas for us to look at.
Mr. Martin.
Members, the problems with the Minneapolis teacher funding issue is a perennial issue that we do think about, and we would be happy to provide you some notions about some alternative solutions as we get closer to the next session. A lot will depend upon the next actuarial valuations, whether we have a further eroding circumstance or whether things have improved. The broad outlines of possible options can be set forth, and then we can refine them as we get the actuarial numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. And Mr. Chair and Mr. Martin, I suppose those options could include the Pogamiller plan and the Knobloch plan, as we heard about them this last session.
Yes, Representative, we would start there, yes.
Very good. Anything else? If not, this meeting is adjourned.
Okay. Well, she admits that we have to do something.
Well,
it's a good start.
All right.
All right. Well, are you walking back?
Yeah, I'm walking back. Okay.
Let me. Who says absolute?